From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. At the end of Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, Huck remarks that he's lighting out for the territory, a comment that underscores his rebellion against conventionality and social oppression. But what specifically is Huck lighting out from, and where's he headed? Those questions are central to a forthcoming interpretation of American literature by one scholar at the National Humanities Center. She is Lucinda McKeithen, a professor of English at North Carolina State University. Joining Lucinda McKeithen in the following discussion of America's literature of lighting out are two other literary historians, Ann Jones and John Sikora. Ann Jones is a scholar at the Institute of Liberal Arts at Emory University. She's the author of Tomorrow is Another Day, a study of 19th-century Southern women's writing, published in 1981. John Sikora is a professor at North Carolina Central University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a study of William Wells Brown and the Afro-American practice of narrative. Cindy, let me begin with you. You are working on a project at the Humanities Center, and your title roughly is America's Literature of Lighting Out. That reminds me of a line from Mark Twain, but you have, what, you're putting a new wrinkle onto that somehow. Tell me about it.
Well, I'm stealing it from Huck Finn, who used it in the last sentence of his novel, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Lighting out for the territory is what he plans to do. And it's an interesting term, lighting out, that's associated with the frontier, an American slang term, which a lot of American critics have used to describe American literature generally, what they mean by American literature. Americans are always lighting out. Its commonest association, and its important one, is with freedom. The freedom to be an individual, the freedom to decide the course of one's own life in particular. And that seems to be what Huck Finn has in mind for it. But it's a very ironic term as well, partly just because when you take it, the whole term, lighting out for the territory, and consider not just the act of escaping, but where Huck is escaping to, where anybody in America gets to light out to, where is the free place, then you automatically encounter, as Huck Finn did when he tried to escape, you encounter the fact of American slavery and the fact that a lot of American literature that's considered the mainstream lighting out literature somehow avoids the fact that lighting out and freedom have most to do in America with the fact of American slavery. So that's what I'm exploring, looking not just at the mainstream literature, but more importantly at the literature which actually dealt with the actual need for freedom, and that is literature having to do with slavery, most importantly, literature written by slaves.
Cindy, you've put a number of issues on the table. Let me ask John Sikora to comment. Cindy McKeithen raises the issue of race. How does that connect?
As Cindy herself has pointed out, it's a striking kind of thing, a striking cultural phenomenon that slave writing has, in some sense, been culturally suppressed for more than 100 years. For the 30-year period that amounts to the golden age of abolitionist slave writing, probably slave narratives were the single most popular literary form in America, in the sense that more slave narratives were published between 1831, say, and the end of the Civil War than any other literary form. You have this huge form that in number of writers, let's say by one estimate, there are 100 separately published antebellum slave narratives. That is, separately published as broadside or pamphlet or book. Then there are more than 500 published in periodicals, abolitionist black and white abolitionist periodicals, and several other forms, like the collection, annual collections done for fundraising of abolition societies. Slave narratives would be collected for that. There are at least 500 of those. Put them all together, and both in volume, in popularity, in sales, in their widespread, reaching across America from the Northeast through the Midwest into Canada, they are probably the one kind of thing Americans, young and old, knew very well. They didn't know Moby Dick. They didn't know Walden. They didn't know Song of Myself, but they knew somebody's slave narrative. Mm-hmm. So it is a very paradoxical thing, and almost a certain sign of repression that we don't know much about that.
Anne Jones is with us today. Our discussion about America's literature of lighting out. Cindy McKeithen has explained the term. John Sikora has been talking about black writing, slave narratives. And tell me how this term, the literature of lighting out, connects with what you're interested in, which is to say women's writing in, what, the middle part of the 19th century?
Right, yeah. I'm delighted that Cindy chose this term, lighting out, for the territory from Huck Finn to organize our thinking today, because it strikes me that we need to look at it both from the point of view of who is lighting out and where the place of freedom exists, and also from the point of view of where they're lighting out from. In Huck Finn in particular, Huck is lighting out from two female figures, Aunt Sally and Aunt Polly, and an even more strongly female figure, Emmeline Grangerford, all of whom represent what for Mark Twain was the terrible effects of women's writing and women's experience. The gender distinctions are also part of the popular literature of the time. John spoke about the slave narratives, the popularity of the slave narratives, and the fact that students or people in their homes would have read slave narratives naturally. They also would have been reading women's literature, the other very popular form, the domestic novel, at the time. People like Mark Twain then are writing against the popularity of women's literature. Hawthorne spoke about the damned mob of scribbling women who gobbled up all the market and kept him from being able to publish his materials and to reach a wide audience. So there was a split, and a hostile split, between women who were writing in the middle of the 19th century and white men who were writing in the middle of the 19th century.
Does this have anything to do with the sort of ongoing disparity between high and low literature, highbrow and lowbrow? Tell me how women's literature or black literature connects to your literary... Cindy McKeithen?
It has to do with that. I think part of the problem with a lot of women's literature, and certainly slave narratives, and Uncle Tom's Cabin as well, which sort of works into both areas, it seems to me, quite importantly, is the problem that we encounter, particularly in academic areas, with literature that also, or even primarily, seems to operate as propaganda. Mm-hmm. The high-low distinctions in literature very often have to do with the problem of message, that if a work is busily propounding a particular political or social point of view, its literary merit traditionally goes down a good bit because it's more interested in its message than it is, you might say, in its metaphors. The more message, the less art. Seems to be the equation, and that, I think, has been an important reason why these works have gone down so heavily in recent years.
Anne Jones?
I have a somewhat different way of approaching this. It strikes me that, in my own experience, the struggle to see beyond my own way of perceiving reality is a constant one. I see this in personal relationships where I notice that I make assumptions about the meaning of someone else's behavior, someone else's gestures, someone else's words that may not correspond to the meaning that that person has intended or has felt behind the what I see.
That's the grand literary challenge, isn't it?
It sure is. What strikes me is that it's also a historical challenge, that that we get ourselves into groups of people who think the same way we do, and we reinforce what I call our narcissism so that I see things the same way people who are like me see them, and it's impossible for me to understand another point of view. I think that it's possible to see what's happening now in the revising of the canon of American literature as, in some ways, challenging what we have thought of as reality or truth, either as fact or as one person's point of view, and instead a way of seeing American experience, American literature, and American history as a series of different voices, mm-hmm. each of which is speaking, but not many of whom are listening to the others. I'm working at the moment on a project called Reconstructing American Literature, whose purpose it is to create an anthology of American literature that will include Chicano voices, Black voices, working class voices, slave voices, as along with the traditional voice of the white man who mm-hmm. has dominated American literature. Mm-hmm.
For the sake of argument, let me present you with the following proposition, Cindy McKeith and Ann Jones, John Sikora. Some critics may say, but this stuff isn't good enough. It's not excellent. It doesn't live up to the standards of literary historical scholarship that have infused, dominated our academies, our university pursuits, and therefore it doesn't belong before the academic audience or doesn't belong in front of a popular audience. Now, you all are talking about a sort of plurality here. You are talking about opening the canon, I think, is one term. John Sikora?
I think these last few words have been the best kind of answer to your original question. For the process that you yourself have begun by getting people to talk about their interests in a complementary, non-competitive way is exactly the answer to deciding what is valuable. I think that perhaps like the military, like the corporation, the world of the academy has too long operated under the rubric of competitive and consuming forces, so that there can be only one single authoritative vision of American literature. And if it happens to exclude lots of people and it happens to include relatively few, mm-hmm. so what? That is survival. That is what we are all about. Well, just asking the three of us to talk together shows us that we don't need to argue that women's literature of the 19th century, or slave writing of the 19th century, or Black writing of the 19th century, needs to find a place in our thinking and our work, driving out all else. On the contrary, it is much saner to be complementary and completing mm-hmm. than to be competitive. Among other things that suggestion might lead to is that since probably before its founding, America had not just one literature, but at least two, and maybe more. That contradicts so many new critical and earlier ideas that a nation, a language, can have only one literature. Well, I think we discover that can't literally be true. How exactly it has to be modified, you know, we can't be absolutely sure about, but it does have to be modified. And then the question of excellence, how excellence is determined. Probably most academics would say, that's a little bit too distant a term, let's break it down. We can dismiss Harriet Beecher Stowe, or we can dismiss Frederick Douglass in earlier ways. They are too propagandistic, and we, trained on New Criticism, don't like direct messages. Or we are very suspicious about that autobiographical form of slave narrative, or maybe we're really suspicious about all autobiography. If there is this great tradition, somehow the notion of autobiography denies, contradicts the whole notion of a tradition. If it's truly autobiography, if it is truly unique writing by a single person with its own shape, it's very difficult to assume that work into a great tradition. So maybe we forget about whether or not Harriet Beecher Stowe is a great writer or Frederick Douglass is a great writer. We simply say the category into which they fall doesn't fit among great writings.
Cindy McKeithen.
That is, of course, unless you are Benjamin Franklin and write an autobiography, which so automatically works to illustrate a certain major economic as well as political theory of why the United States is, then of course the self is subsumed in the symbol of, and he becomes okay as the autobiographical tradition in America.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a discussion of American literature by and about women and blacks in the 19th century. The panelists for Soundings are three literary historians, Lucinda McKeithen, Ann Jones, and John Sikora. Lucinda McKeithen teaches at North Carolina State University. She's the author of The Dream of Arcady, a study of place and time in Southern literature, published in 1980. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Lucinda McKeithen is at work on a forthcoming book entitled America's Literature of Lighting Out, an interpretation of American writing seen in terms of slave narratives and images of escape. John Sikora is a professor of English at North Carolina Central University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a book about William Wells Brown and the Afro-American practice of narrative. Ann Jones is a scholar at the Institute of Liberal Arts at Emory University. In 1983, she served on the editorial board of Reconstructing American Literature, a study of American literary history conducted at Yale University. John Sikora, Ann Jones, Cindy McKeithen, our topic is America's Literature of Lighting Out, which is to say, for our purposes, literature by and about blacks and women, slave narratives. What should American literature look like? If you could wave a magic wand and sort of decree the curriculum. Cindy, let me ask you to comment. You specialize in 19th century American literature. What should students read? What should they know about?
Well, I'll make some very just pure and simple dogmatic statements. It seems to me that one thing we need to abolish in the American literature course is the term major writer. Mm-hmm. I think it would also help us to abolish the term survey. Both of those terms preclude plurality. Mm-hmm. They also inevitably wind up putting into courses that have little enough time as it is, a lot of extra literary terminology whereby we end up studying transcendentalism and naturalism instead of studying Emerson, Margaret Fuller, Kate Chopin, and William Dean Howells in terms of artistic continuums, in terms of shared myths, for instance, that precede what an idea of America is, much less what an idea of American literature is.
John, Sikora?
Three answers to the ideal American lit course. The first and probably most pervasive is all Nathaniel Hawthorne. Exclusively Nathaniel Hawthorne. Wayne knows a little bit about Nathaniel Hawthorne. I have two answers to that question. Two answers. One that comes directly out of our conversation, that it is so easy to do a course in which one book answers another, draws from another, a dialectical course, so that we can use every theme we have spoken of this morning and put it in its history, put it in its context, and include every figure, black, white, young, old, male, female, who was involved and interested and pursuing it. Moreover, the specific kind of thing, it would be easy and beautiful to put together a course on lighting out, carrying it to this present moment in the 20th century.
Now, let me stop you for a moment. How impractical or practical would this enterprise be? You're far more inclusive than you are exclusive, not by way of negativity, not by way of discrimination, but you have to draw some lines. How would you propose to do that? Ann Jones?
I'd like first to give an example of the sort of thing John is talking about. Reading The Scarlet Letter, as almost everyone does, would not be eliminated from a course like this, but it would be read in an exciting way against Linda Brent's narrative. Mm-hmm. Both of them are stories of women who have children out of wedlock. Both of them are stories of entrapment within a society which has values different from the woman. Mm-hmm. So that there are ways in which that dialectical reading specifically will enlighten the old traditional classics as well as introduce the new. To the second point, the question of what you would eliminate from the canon, if you look through anthologies, the most popular of which is the Norton Anthology, what you'll discover is that Whitman has hundreds of pages allotted to him, that Hawthorne has dozens of stories and a novel, whereas someone like Mary Wilkins Freeman has one story, or Frederick Douglass has a chapter from his slave narrative. It's quite possible to conceive of a course in which you teach one novel by Hawthorne instead of one novel plus 10 stories by Hawthorne.
So it's a question of balance.
It's a question of balance.
Right. Anne Jones, John Sikora, Cindy McKeithen. Our topic is women's literature, black literature, slave narratives. Let's conclude. Tell me about a specific example. I'd like each of you briefly to cite a specific example from these categories that you would include in the American literary curriculum. And tell me why you might meet with some resistance. Why might this be difficult to convince students or colleagues that these items belong before popular or academic audiences? Anne Jones, let me begin with you.
I would mention first Linda Brent, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, Kate Chopin, The Awakening, and finally, one we haven't mentioned, Zora Neale Hurston's novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God. These three novels all deal with a problem that has never been seen as a theme in American literature.
What is that?
That is the theme of sex, sexuality. In fact, Leslie Fiedler has argued persuasively that the story of American literature is the story of adolescent boys running away from sex, that only in European literature do you have stories about marriages, about relationships between adult human beings that are sexual in nature. All three of these books talk about the problematic of sexuality for the woman experiencing it. But someone might resist my suggestion by saying, I just don't have the time to do it. Mm-hmm. I just can't possibly get it in there. I need to teach Native Son. I need to teach The Great Gatsby. I can't put Zora Neale Hurston in. Probably pressure from students is one of the most powerful ways in which to include these in the curriculum. Unfortunately, the students need to know about them before they can put the pressure.
John Sikora, comment on that for me and give me an example.
About slave writing, the answer is relatively straightforward, that few of our students or our colleagues even recognize the category. Not only do they not recognize the names of the primary representatives, they don't recognize the category slave narrative at all, for there has been little or nothing in their educational experience up to and including college that has prepared them for them. I would conceive of an ideal course using slave narratives working up through the 20th century, primarily black writing, that could easily be devoted exclusively to the idea of lighting out, particularly around the idea where either within or without oneself can one go to find the light of freedom, the light of responsibility, the light even, for a slave, the journey northward was not simply a geographic journey, but a symbolic journey, where leaving a plantation in Florida where one could not be a legal being, an economic being, a sexual being, a religious being, any kind of autonomous being, every step forward on that road toward the North Star, let one be more autonomous, more of an economic being where one could sell one's labor. One could be more of an intellectual being where one could decide one's own fate, make one's own ideas, a political being, a sexual being, where one could form a marriage, mm-hmm. and start a family that wouldn't have to be broken up by some slave owner's will. So one could go back as far as 1760, and one could go as far forward as Toni Morrison and Tar Baby, or maybe John Edgar Wideman, Brothers and Keepers, perhaps for the 20th century, as Douglas is monumental in the 19th, Richard Wright and Black Boy, alongside Malcolm X and his autobiography, are monumental in the same way. And so the literature of lighting out, slave writing, we can go 1760 to 1984 with great ease.
Cindy McKeithen.
I'll give you three quick examples of what I would say, if I could, to students as I teach them in American literature would be something like this. We'll say, you sort of have to read James Fenimore Cooper's The Prairie because it gives you this image of the American man at the edge of the wilderness, fleeing law and trying to find the sacredness of self. I would say that if you have to read The Prairie, you also have to read a not too highly regarded slave narrative by a man named Henry Bibb, who found himself on the wrong side of the Red River escaped from an Indian master, stole a horse, and took the plains way to Jefferson City, and then mingled with whites on a boat as far as St. Louis, and finally made his way to Detroit. The journey west becomes the journey of the rejection of the West, as much as it is the rejection of the slave South. You find that demographically speaking, where is the free place? Natty Bumppo had trouble finding it, so did Henry Bibb. Then I would say that if you have to read Walden, you have to watch Henry David Thoreau make himself into a persona who creates for himself near the railroad track, but not too near, a cabin from which he can announce the total freedom of his self within his own self-constructed world. I would say you would also have to read the narrative of Linda Brent and experience with her 7 years life of freedom in her grandmother's cabin. As a woman escaping slavery, unlike so many of the male slave narrators, she couldn't take the road or the first boat out in disguise. And instead of doing that, she found the only way she could escape her master was to live for 7 years in the attic of her grandmother's house, where she was free from her master and free from the whip. And yet the whole paradigm of the cabin and her total immobility for those 7 years shows the exclusion of the American promise of freedom for both women and slaves. And then I would say, if you're going to read Melville, if you're going to read Moby Dick, and you're going to watch Ishmael in his great funk jump onto that boat and go off questing for the reality of who he is, in conjunction with Ahab confronting the whale as evil, I would say you would also have to read either William Wells Brown's narrative or Frederick Douglass's, where Frederick Douglass watches the great white ships in the Chesapeake Bay and says, "You are loosed from your moorings. I too will have the water bear me away to freedom." Or you would watch William Wells Brown on the Mississippi River, on the boat that took him as the assistant to a slave driver down to New Orleans, where he had to paint the slaves literally to make them blacker and healthier looking and paint their hair so they looked healthy. And I would say that those quests are simultaneous and that you really should not have one without the other.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about American literature by and about blacks and women in the 19th century. The panelists for Soundings were three literary historians: Lucinda McKeithen of North Carolina State University, Ann Jones of the Institute of Liberal Arts at Emory University, and John Socorro of North Carolina Central University. Lucinda McKeithen and John Socorro are fellows of the National Humanities Center. Next week on Soundings, John Seeley of the University of Florida will discuss his forthcoming study of American literature entitled Beautiful Machine, Rivers and the Emerging American Republic. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.